This is Michael Reinhart, welcoming you to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. We are led by our two hosts, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. This podcast is sponsored by the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a 50% discount on membership to our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use code POD. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and please feel free to leave us a rating or comment.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry Buckley. And we are honored this morning to have Bill Siglein with us. Bill is the founder of CISO Executive Network and has probably done more to influence the cybersecurity community in the United States than anyone I can think of, except maybe Ron Ross. And so he's really done a fabulous job in establishing this network of chapters comprised of CISO members. And Bill, let's start there and tell us why you started the CISO Executive Network and a little bit about how it's evolved over the years.
Absolutely. Jody and Jerry, thank you so much for having me join you today. It's a privilege to spend some time with you, and I certainly appreciate it. And your compliments are greatly appreciated. And I think I'm just the quiet guy who sits in the corner and influences from there. But it's funny, I started CISO Executive Network under a different moniker. At the time, it was called the CSO Breakfast Club. And it actually came to me, the idea came to me with a board member at a company I was working for. And I said, how do I make sure I'm spending time with CISOs who are influential? I really want to find out what they're doing and pick their brains. And he mentioned something he was doing out on the West Coast. Literally that night, the light bulb went off and I came back and I decided CSO Breakfast Club would become a thing. And I went ahead and built a website and started putting CISOs together in Baltimore where I live. And quite frankly, it was sort of a selfish motivation, Jody. I wanted to find out what CISOs were doing. I was a contract CISO and I wanted to make sure I was on the right track. And I thought, well, what better way than to get in a room full of these folks and let them share their ideas and then I could bounce ideas off of them. And so quite frankly, it took off. And I started in Baltimore about once a quarter, just meeting in my old office at T. Rowe Price in their data center. And we would just have bagels and coffee and talk about a different topic, right? And suddenly someone in Pittsburgh, someone that you and I jointly know, said, hey, come on up here to Pittsburgh and do that thing you're doing in Baltimore. And then word got to Philadelphia and New York. And before I knew it, I had five of these active chapters going on and I had to quit my gig as a virtual CISO. and do it all full time. And I had to monetize it, right? I had to make a living. And I figured that out by doing sponsorships. I let the vendors come sit in the room for a little while and let them add some value to the conversation. And that's where it's gone. It's been very exciting.
And you have how many now?
Jody, it's crazy. We're up to 23 chapters with a 24th coming online before the end of the year, nearly 170 roundtables a year. So when we are doing them in person, the travel is, as you can imagine, crazy because there's really only two of us that moderate the roundtables. And so we just go from city to city over and over again because each chapter meets seven times a year. So a lot, but it's worth every moment on the road because of the value of hearing these CISOs get better at their jobs and what they do and the relationships that they form and the community that they've built.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been to several of your meetings and they really are value added for anybody who attends them. I wondered if you could share with our listeners what they're generally saying about the current threat environment. You have, you know, insight into a lot of different views and also note whether remote working has played a role.
Yeah, it's so timely, isn't it? It's very interesting, you know, as we spend all this time with our CISOs, even though it's all virtual now, I mean, they really confess their sins. We literally jokingly call the first hour confessional because it's the CISOs introducing themselves and walking through a poll question and then some icebreaker questions. And they're really letting it out. They feel safe in this environment. And so a couple of things have come up. Ransomware, clearly way at the top of the list because it's hitting everybody. The lawyers that are in each of our roundtables, as you know, Jody, we dedicate 10 minutes to what we call a host law firm. It's physically where we sit when we are in person. And almost every one of them has said they have paid millions and millions of dollars in ransomware this year. And if you just look at the insurance companies who have all said, this is insane. We did not write these policies properly. We're backing off, making all new requirements. And I've heard 300% increase in premiums as a minimum. So ransomware is an issue. They're losing sleep over it. And the remote work thing, it's so interesting that our members have said that if they had already allowed some amount of remote work, they were prepared for this. Their biggest issue was finding technology. They couldn't get laptops fast enough, as it was clearly a problem across the globe. But that's the number one threat vector. And of course, it's individual. It really only takes one click. It's one user, one click, and the bad guy's in with ransomware. And the training has been the number one feature. We actually do a poll. We did a poll early in the year on this threat topic. It was called Risky User Behavior, was our title for our series. And we asked members, since work from home is probably going to become the new normal and remote work will be here forever, how would you rank different security technology controls? And the number one thing was identity and access management controls, the ways you log in and authenticate yourself. They said that they're paying a lot of attention to that. And, multi-factor authentication, where you get a code to your phone, and which most of us are used to anyway, at the bank and so forth, right, with different apps. But that is the number one thing they seem to be investing their time and effort into. There's a few other things. One thing is behavioral analytics software, which sounded like a great idea, right? Something that tracks what people are doing and how they react and what they're touching and how they're typing. And we thought that would be way up on the list. You know, it ended up being at the bottom. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm kind of shocked by it. But then the members explained they're doing basic blocking and tackling, and they don't have time for these fancy technology solutions right now.
Install it and going to analyze it.
Right. So I guess the other thing that was really popular, of course, is training users to spot phishing email, the anti-phishing email campaigns, which, you know, the average employee says, what a pain in the butt that is, right? I hate having to go through that silly 2.5 to 3 minute training. I said, but it makes the difference, because even at home now, you know, your spidey sense kicks in and there are things that you don't click on, and you've probably saved yourself a lot of heartache.
Well, they're really sophisticated. I mean, I even have to stop and think sometimes when I look at these emails. I mean, they're getting very good.
They sure are.
Yeah. Well, I want to throw this over to Jerry and bring him in. Jerry?
Well, thanks, Jody. And Bill, thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. In looking at privacy and cybersecurity issues, we've looked at various policy and legislative angles. One suggestion that keeps coming up is tax credits for cybersecurity spending. Do you think that would make a difference? What are the top 4 or 5 things that CISOs want and need but don't have the funding for?
Yeah, that's such a great question, right? Where can they find funding? And it's interesting, the perspective we get from talking to so many of these CISOs, and the ones who are getting money and the ones who aren't. And it's not always the biggest companies that spend the money. You would think the huge companies were probably spending oodles of money on cybersecurity. And sometimes it's not how much you spend, it's how wisely you spend it. So do I think the idea of a tax credit would work? I think the first blush is, what a great idea, right? Here, if you guys invest, you'll get some tax credit. But it sort of lets the company off the hook in a way. It says, you know, we're going to reward you for spending money on cybersecurity. Quite frankly, they just should be doing it. I get that they probably won't unless they have to. I just don't want it to ever become a checkbox thing, right? It's, well, we do it because someone's going to give us a tax break, right? The company will put pressure on the CISO. Hey, go buy some security products. Make it look like we're doing something. And I don't want to indicate that maybe companies aren't always doing the right thing, but we know how companies operate, right? Most are for profit. And spending money on cybersecurity isn't making you profitable. It's a cost. So I'm a little leery about that. They also don't really like heavy regulation, because that also then puts the checkbox mentality. Do I have this in place? Do I have that in place? Mm-hmm. And our members talk about that all the time is, you know, I'm working so hard to comply with all of these regulations, security and privacy regulations, that I'm not sure I'm actually cutting any risk. I'd rather focus on risk reduction. If that happens to check a few boxes, that's great. But of course, compliance must be met. So I'm not sure the tax credit idea will work, but perhaps it will. Maybe we need to try something new.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. Not exactly the answer I would have expected.
Yeah. So, but you also asked, I think, where do CISOs want to spend money, right? Where do they need some relief? And I think there's four things that come to mind based on conversations over the last few years, right? One is all the information security teams want to automate as much as they can because they can't get enough staff. Shortages, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure that'll come up at some point, but it's hard to find enough people. And so we want to automate security operations, things like going and fixing a vulnerability on a laptop, right? If we can do that through pure automation, software just goes and does it. That would be great. Or investigating or responding to an incident. If we could do most of that through automation, some scripts and things, that would help. CISOs are also looking for ways to see better into the cloud, right? Everybody's in Azure or Google or AWS, and most of them are in multiple clouds at one time. And the CISOs in our network say they're blind. They operate very blind in those cloud environments. They rely on what those providers give you. So they would love better visibility and control. Data governance is another big issue where they need to spend time and money. There's too much data. Everybody wants to collect a lot of it and make money off of it. So they'd love to have tools and processes that will help you govern who touches data and where it goes. And the last thing is, we even mentioned it earlier, this identity and access management. Everything that touches an application or our network has an identity. Even in your house, your oven, if it's internet connected, you know, your television has an identity. And so we have to manage those identities. So we're looking for solutions in that space as well.
Pretty impressive agenda, isn't it? To divert for a second and talk about the willingness to fund, do you think that the prevalence and growth of ransomware attacks and the increased cost of insurance may be a motivator for management to spend the money that they haven't spent so far?
That is probably going to be a huge driver for this and next year. Our members have indicated that the boards are highly awake to this issue. And so CISOs are getting, you know, a little more exposure, and they're saying, hey, listen, I've been telling you this for years. We need to do these 3, 4, 5 things very well to protect ourselves. And by the way, now we have to do those things in order to even get underwritten by an insurance company. So that alone, the fact that insurance will not even underwrite companies unless they have some controls in place will probably be a reason for them to crack open the wallet and start spending on cybersecurity greater than they have in the past.
Well, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we do hear a lot about the labor shortage in the cybersecurity field and how difficult it is for small and mid-sized companies to hire security personnel and keep them.
Right.
What's happening in the system now? You know, are there really shortages, and what strategies are there for dealing with them?
Yeah. So studies have said over the last 2 years that it's like a 2+ million person shortage globally for cybersecurity. That's just a phenomenal gap. And so our members are constantly trying to find and retain good people. And you're right. It's the mid-market that has the hardest time. We have members in mid-sized banks, community banks, and things like that who say, I can't compete with a PNC. I'm never going to get those great analysts. And I can't give salaries like they are. So I'm going to lose people to them. Those are the companies, by the way, that are demanding the automation. They need products that will automate to replace humans. But in the meantime, the pandemic created, oddly, an opportunity to start hiring people globally. And so they've actually started to close the gap. As a matter of fact, in the series we just finished, we visited all 23 cities over about a 5-week period. In the morning icebreaker time for the first 30 minutes, one of the things I asked most of my members was, have you hired during the pandemic and how has that process been? Were you successful? Did you use recruiters? Those sorts of things. I was surprised to hear how many said absolutely hired and successfully hired, with the exception of a few horror stories, and I'll tell you one of those. But for the most part, it's been very successful because they don't have to hire in their local community. They can now reach globally. Since it looks like their teams are going to remain work from home for a long period of time, possibly permanently. So because that market's bigger, it's easier to hire and they're getting a better talent. Here's another trick though. CISOs gave up on the market a while ago because they couldn't find talent. They couldn't get them in the door fast enough. literally people would get 3 and 4 offers in one day and pick the highest bid. So what they started to do is look internally to their own companies and recruit within and convert people to security people. They've learned that people who are analytical make great security analysts. So accountants, they steal people from the accounting department and say, look, I know you hate your life. That's not a bad plug on accounting, but you know, hey, come over to the cybersecurity side. We're going to have you analyze patterns in log data, right? So they're recruiting people from within, from all walks of the business, and they have been tremendously successful at that, which is a great thing to hear. One of the problems in hiring is HR tends to get in the way. They move too slowly. The job descriptions are bad. I hear you nodding your head over there, Jody.
Yeah.
Yep. And they also don't have salary structures in the proper range. They're woefully behind. Because of the demand issue, salaries have gone up many percentage, sometimes 100% or more. And so our members say, I have to convince HR to restructure a lot of these people because I need to hire analysts now at 6 figures and more just to get them in the door and keep them. So it's a big problem. I'll tell you one quick little story. It's probably not super unique, but we've had a couple members say they hired a person during the pandemic. They had a start date. And on the start date, that person didn't show up. And they thought, oh, maybe it's just a technology glitch. Let's call them. And they called the person. They said, oh, no, I got a better offer from the time you signed to be up and the time that today's start date was. So I just took that better offer. He didn't bother to call us and tell us. It's kind of crazy. It is a seller's market right now. So
I think it's part of that generation.
I think so too, right? There's a millennial generation of workers who don't work quite the way that everybody else does. The good news is they're efficient when they work from home, even though they might be gaming or whatever it is. That's another thing our members say, that their teams are incredibly efficient because they have a tendency to work all day long in small spurts. And that seems to work. I'm probably like you, Jody and Jerry. I'm an old school person. I like a handshake and an eyeball. I want to meet at the water cooler. And so the way our members are getting around that is to have team huddles every day, a short team huddle, and then maybe once a week a meeting. And some are even saying, if you're in the region, come to the office. And after work, we might go get a cocktail or we'll have lunch or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, the EU defines reporting lines for data protection officers. And they set forth responsibilities for data protection and cybersecurity in their laws. The CISOs have, we know, long chafed at the CIO-CISO reporting relationship that unfortunately is still very common. Is this really a problem? And if so, what's the solution? Who do they think they should report to, if not the CIO? And is this an area Congress should weigh in on?
It's a very good question and something that comes up every year for the last 10 years. We've been waging this battle for a long time. There is clearly a conflict of interest between what the CISO does and the CIO. The CIO, his or her job is to get systems operational and help the company make money. The CISO's job is to make sure things are secure. So sometimes the CISO will say, that system should not go operational. It's not functionally secure yet. And the CIO overrules it and says, we committed to a date. It's going to go live on that date. So do we think the CISO and the CIO should be peers? Absolutely. Is it that way? It's getting more that way. More and more companies are setting it up that way. And yet, every year when I ask members, do you report to the CIO? There's still a large percentage who do. And then I ask them, is it a problem for you? And for the most part, they say, as long as I have a good relationship with my CIO, I have no problems. I'm perfectly okay with it. There's only a few who are really frustrated. So I don't know if we need to legislate it or regulate it. I think bodies that set guidelines should continue to emphasize the need for the CISO to be independent, perhaps with a dotted line to the board. So things that you publish, Jody, I think, you know, those are the kinds of things that will get traction. I don't know that we need to do it with a hammer. I think we can do it by just convincing. So it is an issue. And yet the CISOs have been successful reporting to the CIO.
Do you think that the insurance companies who are now revising their requirements may require the CISO to have more independence from the CIO?
That's a good thought. I have not heard that. I would suspect that at a minimum, the insurance companies are going to say there must be a chain of governance that makes us all the way to the board. And however you structure it, the board must be made aware of cybersecurity situations and conditions. And so I think that will allude to the fact that the CISO should be independent. I don't know if they'll be that specific in their guidance.
Yeah, I think the insurance market's a ways away from that because you know what's really going to drive the board's attention is the D&O coverage and if they get held personally liable.
Exactly.
That's on the D&O side. And D&O policies can be largely silent on cyber, but there's been massive litigation after major cyber events that has included shareholder derivative and securities class action lawsuits. And the issue with that is one of those cases can use up the entire legal limit on a D&O policy. And so that's something, you know, the insurance industry tends to operate in stovepipes, and cyber is one of them. D&O is another one. But this perception that CIOs know infrastructure and also are cybersecurity experts, that myth just has to be debunked because CIOs don't know security. If anything, the reporting relationship should be flipped and CIOs should report to CISOs. But instead of going that extreme, you're right, having them as peers is a better way.
I think that's a first step, like, you know, going to hybrid vehicles before we go all electric, right? So I think, I think having the CISO as a peer to the CIO, because I think the role of the CIO is going to change to being a contract babysitter for outsourced third-party stuff. I mean, everything's in the cloud and all our apps are somewhere else. So I think the role of the CISO will become elevated. And of course, you know, we may get to this in our discussion today is the merging of privacy and security. So,
yeah, but let's in this CIO-CISO relationship, let's talk about board reporting because very often the CIOs will struggle to get in front of the board. They'll, if they report to the CIO, very often the CIO does the reporting, even though the, you know, they don't know cybersecurity. They take the presentation and present it. Are CISOs really, though, prepared to do board presentations? Are they prepared to leave out the acronyms and the geek speak and make meaningful board presentations? I've always perceived that as a skill gap with CIOs. Is that unfair?
Yeah, that's such a great point, right? Having done this now for over 15 years, I've seen CISOs mature, which is a good thing. We were a room full of nerds 15 years ago. I mean, the geek speak was phenomenal. It was nothing but acronyms and I know knuckle cracking. It was, but boy, we have gotten better. Yet still today, I can look across our 2,000 members and pick out the ones that I'd say, I would never want him or her to present to the board because wow, right? The board would glaze over in 30 seconds. And so I'm like, boy, I'm thankful that person reports to the CIO. But there are many, many CISOs who have gotten significantly better at speaking business and they get that this is all about risk. It's all about how do I enhance the business to go make the widgets that we make? And they start talking more about things like resiliency, the ability to meet demand, supply chain, right? All these important things to the business. And the ones who get that, they get time in front of the board. It's fun to see a CISO who has actually matured from the role of, I was the director of information security, and they recently made me the official CISO. And sometimes that person will come to me and say, Bill, I have to report to the board. I'm petrified. I've never done it before. And I say, well, you know what? Let me get you on the phone with three other members who have been reporting to the board for a while and let them coach you a little bit. That's the benefit of our community. We do this thing once a year. Jody, you have probably even participated in one of the roundtables where we did this workshop. We break members into groups of four or five. We give them a scenario. We say you have 15 minutes to read the scenario and come up with a single slide to report to the board. And then we give them 5 minutes to report to the board. The board is everybody else sitting in the room. And it is such a great exercise because usually there's a mix of a person who's been reporting to the board for a while, someone who's never done it before, and a few people are just starting to do it. They learn from each other. They literally take photos of each other's whiteboards because they say, oh, that's a great idea. I'd never thought of reporting that particular risk metric to the board, and I will start doing that going forward. So we're getting better. CISOs should report to the board. Every board should ask for their CISO to report to the board. There are CISOs who probably are not properly equipped to do that.
Jerry, let me throw this back to you.
Yeah, and thanks, Jody. And, you know, since we cover both privacy and cybersecurity in this podcast, I'd like to ask whether CISOs interact very often with the privacy personnel in their organizations. In the legal world, we'll deal with privacy compliance issues, but now there are 27 states with laws setting out cybersecurity requirements for personal data. Is there a gap between the CPOs and the CISOs that should be bridged? If so, what are your thoughts about how that might be done?
Well, Jerry, I'm very happy to report that the relationship between privacy officers and security officers is significantly better than CISOs and CIOs. Most of our members are thrilled that the companies have finally assigned someone to be the privacy officer. And it's often somebody from the legal office, right? It's legal or compliance who takes that role on. There are also situations where the CISO is named the privacy officer. Especially for European data things, there's a lot of CISOs who are also the DPO. I'm not sure I'm on board with the CISO also being the privacy officer. Some can make that argument that it works very well. I'm reluctant to go down that path. But where there is a separate privacy officer and security officer, I've noticed that they work incredibly tightly together, hand in hand. Privacy officer comes to the security officer and says, we have to make sure this data doesn't get touched. What controls do we have in place? The smart CISO realizes that privacy is a high priority today and is getting attention and money. Whereas the CISO's been around so long that he or she's operational, budgets stay the same, sometimes shrink, sometimes go up, you know, minute amount. What a great way to team up when the CISO goes to the CPO and says, let's both go get money for this. Like, I'm going to ride your coattails. Let's ask for this security solution because it'll help you meet privacy requirements. And yet I'll get a benefit too. And I'll even operate it for you. So you don't even have to bother with it. You just get the reports from it. So the smart ones are working closely hand in hand. And most have sort of a committee, a security and privacy committee that they all team up on. So I think it's a good thing. I think privacy as a driver has made security better.
And the privacy personnel, often coming from the legal side, are bringing a governance view that probably is helpful to the CISO as well.
No question, right? I mean, the CISO has finally started to speak the governance language, right? That vernacular has kicked in here. CISOs have started to realize that, especially for data, data governance is a huge issue. Who owns it? Who should control and protect it? You know, one of the things that's a myth within most companies is the CISO owns data and puts protective controls on it. And the answer is no, that's not the case at all. The CISO is an advisor to the business units. And the business owns all the data. The CISO just says, hey, listen, according to this regulation, you have to protect this data. I have some controls that could do that if you would like me to apply them. But for data in particular, who owns it? Who's responsible for seeing where it goes, where it doesn't go? I joke around, I say, the CISOs, we see the plumbing. We see where data flows and where it goes and what buckets it goes into and who touches it all day long. So when you go to the business unit and you say, do you own this data? And they say, oh, no, we don't. And then you show them the facts. Well, here's some statistics that show 75% of your employees access this data every single day. Must be pretty important to you. So because we see the plumbing, we can tell the business how it actually functions. It's very interesting.
You know, Bill, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Jody Westby has developed a course called the Data Privacy and Protection Specialist Course, which brings together the governance and the data protection personnel and brings that vision that is the larger vision. And it's certainly something our listeners may want to look at.
Absolutely,
Right. Now, you know, we deal with policy issues here a lot. And if your CISO executive network could advise Congress on what to do regarding cybersecurity, what do you think your members would say to them? What do you think they want Congress to do to improve security and make their jobs easier? Or what would they want the White House or some executive agency such as DHS or FTC to do?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of arms of government who have dipped their toes into the cybersecurity and privacy realm. We're seeing regulations and guidance from so many different agencies. Sometimes it's conflicting and confusing. I would say one thing that's already happened, right? This new administration has made cybersecurity a high priority, especially for critical infrastructure. They've set some guidance out. Of course, CISA, big important organization. So I think we're on the right path, and I think that's important, for years said, will there be a federal data security law that supersedes the independent state laws? We'd love to see it. Wouldn't it be nice if, as a CISO, you had to comply with one and then all the states would fall in line? I'm highly doubtful that will occur, even with the current administration, even if they were to pass a national data security and privacy law. I'm not sure that it would supersede states, because we're such a states' rights oriented country that states will still want to have their own additional security controls and privacy controls in place. And because there's been an absence of a federal law on this, right, you see the states who emerge, Massachusetts and California, always the first two to the table with very strict security and privacy laws, just making it more complicated. So what would our CISOs like to see Congress do? I think it's appropriate money, clear the path for sharing intelligence with businesses when there are attackers, and we know about this from the intelligence community. And there's some of that occurs with InfraGuard and others. I think it needs to be a little bit more pervasive. We need to see more timely. And I think they would love to see consistent guidance coming down from the federal government. Not so many independent government agencies sending things out, maybe just one federal set of guidance on this. And maybe CISA will be that agency that starts to set that. I'm not sure we'll ever get there. It's a big wish, right? We'd love to see consistent guidance. I'm not sure that will happen. I hope that answered your question, Jerry.
It does. And in fact, you know, I think the perception of the cyber threat and the threat from nation states should cause our government to be more focused on the need for a unified response. Maybe these challenges will drive us in that direction, but you're right. It's hard to overcome this plethora of state laws that have developed. Now that they're there, if we'd acted initially with one national standard, that would be one thing, but we're not there, and it's going to be hard to herd those cats. So,
yeah, I mean, we know that nation states are actively participating in cyber attacks against us. And yet, because the way our government is structured, we're never going to do that, right? We have our own offensive arm in the Department of Defense, but we will never participate in an offensive fashion for business. And that's a good thing, I think. Nonetheless, our companies are getting hammered by these bad guys. So any assistance where the federal government can come in and say, an attack is imminent, we know it. We're going to give you some tools and resources to help stop this. That's where I think we need some support.
Well, you know, when I think about the EU, ever since 1995, when the Data Protection Directive came out, you know, was replaced by GDPR, U.S. businesses have howled with the compliance costs of complying with EU privacy requirements. And, you know, I pretty much decided they've had the best approach, because it's personal data. It's personal data. It doesn't matter if you're an employee, if you're not an employee. They're not slicing and dicing it up by whether you're financial or whether you're health or whether you're this or that, and having all these different departments and regulations and laws apply to this jelly bean bowl of data. And now I think the compliance requirements in the U.S. are harder than complying with the EU. And I don't see that letting up, because as you just so well described, it is a complex problem for CISOs and privacy personnel.
Now, if we're so busy jumping hurdles to make checks and checkboxes, we've taken our eye off the risk side. So it's a side effect that we didn't intend with these regulations, but it has happened.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of our time, but thank you so much, Bill, for joining us today and sharing this perspective. I think it's really valuable to have input about what the CISO community is thinking, and this has been great. So thanks again, and we look forward to having you another session. Jerry?
Again, thanks, Bill. It's been excellent to have this conversation, and we really appreciate your making the time to do it.
Thank you for joining us this week on the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy the show and want more content on the issues we cover, you can visit adcg.org. The Association for Data and Cyber Governance is the leading association connecting all aspects of data management, cybersecurity, and governance. our listeners can use code POD at checkout for 50% off membership. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.